Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to another Rahala Stuffer book club. I am delighted to be joined by Kat Jarman, who has written a fantastic book called The Bone Chests, Unlocking the Secrets of the Anglo-Saxons. They all have a subheading now. Hello, Kat. How are you doing?
Hello. Great to be here.
Oh, lovely to have you. Thank you very much for the book. It's terrific. Let's start by telling me a little bit about yourself and what you've done before The Bone Chests.
Right, yes. So I am, by training, I'm an archaeologist or a bioarchaeologist, which means that most of my work is focused on human remains. And I do a lot of that. I did a PhD in the Vikings, Viking Age, England, 9th century, looking at a mass grave, trying to work out who on earth was in this grave in Derbyshire. And that led to my first book, which is called River Kings. And that was very much about the Vikings and the Vikings' connections with the Silk Roads and the East. I followed a little bead eastwards from Repton, from Derbyshire, and back to its origins in India. So that's kind of what I did before that, and a bit of broadcasting work. I do podcasting and that sort of thing myself as well. So then it led to The Bone Chest, which is my second book.
Yes, and bioarchaeology is very... I've been reading a few books recently. We had a few books on the book club from archaeologists. There was a member one about the Neanderthals, which I think, again, calls on this. You know, it's sort of incredible what you can pull up from teeth especially, but bones as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the advances in that branch of archaeology?
Yeah, I mean, I find it extremely exciting. It's a sort of CSI Vikings or CSI archaeology or something like that, really, because we are basically like walking diaries of our lives, and everything we do, you know, everything we eat and drink becomes part of our bodies and our skin and our hair and our bones and our teeth. So we have all these this bit of evidence essentially of who we are and where we've grown up locked into our bodies. And the amazing thing is that we now have the technology to unlock that and to find it in these ancient bodies. So we can find a skeleton which, you know, 100 years ago you knew practically nothing about, and then you can find all this information about where they grew up geographically, if they've moved, if they migrated, what sort of food they ate, and then you can sort of build this big picture of who they were with both something called isotope analysis and things like ancient DNA, diseases, illnesses, family relationships. It's absolutely extraordinary and very exciting.
Yeah, which does cast a bit more light on the early medieval period, which is sort of, you know, not the sources aren't great. The written sources aren't great compared to, say, what we get from Rome. But it is extraordinary what we're getting. But let's get on to this book. It's funny because I came across this book sort of by accident when it first came out. I'd just done a gig in Winchester, and I always take the piss out of the city a bit beforehand. And so I'd been on Wikipedia and seen the bone chest, which I may have heard of before, but I'm not sure I had. And I was taking the mickey out of the audience for having all the... There's these bone chests in Winchester Cathedral that contain the bones of several kings of England and other personages. So I was taking the mickey out of them for not making more of it, as Richard III has shown for Leicester, who do not own the bones there from York. We'll make that point, as I always do. And then I saw this book. I thought, oh, I've got to read this and find... Because I've never been to... I've been to the cathedral, but I've never seen them. So tell us a little bit about the bone chests and why you got interested in them, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're really fascinating because I found out through my work sort of probably 10, 15 years ago or something like that. But most people haven't heard of them at all. But you go into the cathedral and you can easily miss them. But you go down to the choir and you look up and there are these six wooden chests, beautifully carved with little sort of inscriptions on them. And they contain some of the most illustrious kings and bishops and a queen dating from the 7th and right up to the 12th century, all essentially squashed into these tiny little chests. And they just sort of stuck there and you just walk past and you go, yeah, that's nice. But actually, these are some of the people who essentially helped shape England as a country, and they include a Viking king as well, which is extraordinary. But then they also have this amazing later history, including this parliamentarian raid in 1642 where they were attacked. The whole cathedral is attacked, but even the chests were smashed to the ground, and people have been essentially after them for hundreds of years. So there's this huge, big story to unravel, both of the people who are in there, those sort of original kings and bishops, but also that what people have done with them, thought about these chests.
Yeah, so there's about 23 individual, I mean, not complete skeletons, but bits of pieces, which have been transferred, presumably, mostly from... grave, so that people might be surprised to find Winchester was the heart of, you know, was the essential capital or the royal residence of England as well at this point. So tell us why all the kings are there.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, this is the thing again that's quite surprising. Before London, it was Winchester was essentially the capital of the entire country, and it's partially because Wessex, this Anglo-Saxon kingdom, was the one that was the sort of the greatest of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms at the time, and Winchester and the cathedral there was the sort of key of that again. And that starts right back in the 7th century. So some of these burials would have initially been in the same place, in the ground originally. The cathedral is actually an 11th century creation, so that's quite recent, but it replaces earlier churches. So people have collected and curated these bones, taken them out of the ground and moved them about for centuries before they end up in these chests.
Yeah, and I suppose the appeal of Richard III is he's such a famous king and there's such a story behind it. And with these kings, some of them people won't have heard of. Some of them, I mean, there's William II's in there, Rufus, who was one of my favourite stories of a death of a king, at least. You know, he wasn't that great a king. I guess if presumably King Alfred... I can't remember if this is in the book. You say this in the book or not? But he might have been buried somewhere in Winchester. Is that right? But he's not in the, as far as we know, he's not in the chests.
Yeah, so he was also buried in Winchester originally in one of the churches that was the sort of precursor to the cathedral. But he was then later moved to Hyde Abbey, which is again in Winchester as well. And then that, when that was destroyed, we don't know what happened to him. So we lost him. He's probably one of the most notorious kings we've ever had, and we've managed to lose him, which is a bit of a shame. But he was never named as one of the people on these chests. So they've got this amazing history. So you mentioned the number 23, and that's actually a recent number. I count all the people in the chests from modern research. But originally, there was only about 11 or 12 named on them. So we have all these excess people that we have not that much information about who they are, why they're there. And Alfred he's never been named as having been moved into the chest. So we don't think that ever happened. We think he was buried elsewhere in, or sort of moved elsewhere in Winchester, and then somehow we lost track.
Yeah, yeah. It is sort of a fascinating thing. I've really struggled with especially early medieval history. I think partly because I didn't study it at school, or I did history at university, but it was all sort of 1066 onwards. And I didn't do any work, which is part of the problem. I did comedy instead.
Doesn't help.
It doesn't help. But I think the struggle to get in there is because, A, there's not so much information. The kings aren't so well known, but they've all got these very similar complicated names, usually starting Ethel something, and so the queen, if the queens are named, they have kind of very confusing names. How do you manage to keep as I'm studying this, is it easier to keep track of than it is reading it? Because a lot of it, this book obviously talks about the bone chest, but then also talks about the history of England and the kings and queens that may be there. Is that something you struggle with, to keep track of who's who?
Absolutely, 100%. It was a complete nightmare, if I'm going to be really honest. And it was probably the one thing that made me almost stop writing this book halfway through, is all these blooming people I couldn't keep track of. And some of them are really exciting and have really fun stories, and some of them are incredibly boring. And you think, well, okay, that's fine. You've got this name and you've got a few little events, and you think, really? Does anybody care? And you're trying to remember what they're called. And some of the women get renamed as well and given the same name. That's not really very helpful. And then it's how to spell them, how to pronounce them. And, it is a complete nightmare. And also, because my background is in archaeology and bioarchaeology, I'm not a historian. And so I'm actually quite used to people who have no names, just thinking of the bodies and the other evidence. So yeah, I have to admit, I really didn't enjoy that part. So when we come to Alfred or Emma or somebody like that, you go, yes, I feel safe now and comfortable.
Canute. I mean, there's lots of reasons why he's memorable, but and it's easy to remember that name. But once it gets onto those slightly closer ones, it does get a little bit easier, it has to be said. But I am still fascinated by it. Is David Mitchell's book, which we've talked about on this podcast as well, talked to David about it. He does try to cover a lot of those kings, which I think is very bold. And there are stories there, and it is I suppose it's. Unlike Richard III, there's no way to identify directly who these people are, because Richard III was partly proven to be him because he looked like him, and also because he has living descendants, which we don't have living descendants. Well, we do, but we don't know who they are of these people.
Yeah, so one of the big problems we have is that even if we can identify someone and can get the DNA out of there, we don't have anything to compare them to. But I do think that we might get a bit closer, because one of the exciting things we can do now is we can work out family relationships. Yeah. So we can find, and this is quite new, we can get, first degree relationship. We can work out if somebody's father and daughter and brothers and cousins and so on. And as we get more and more of them, we start to find connections between different bodies. So if we find one and we're quite confident, so for example there's one woman that's been found among these remains, and we're fairly confident that it's probably Emma of Normandy, and we know who her family was, and so we know that she's related to all these different people. So I feel like in maybe 10-20 years we can do these elaborate networks and connections and actually narrow it down that way, which I think is very cool.
I mean, it's it's sort of astonishing, going back 1,000 years, being able to do this, going back thousands of years with the Neanderthals and being able to kind of discover stuff about their lives. It is a developing science, you know, and who knows where it'll go and where it'll lead. But it is very, very exciting. You mentioned Emma there, and she is the only woman there. You do write about quite a lot of the female characters from this time, but again, it's difficult, as you say. They either change their names, or sometimes they're not named. They're just called the Queen. They're not even named in the sources. But I think you do a good job of bringing a lot of these characters to life. And obviously, women were 50% of the story, so it's weird that we have so little about them.
Absolutely, and that's in the written record. So the one you mentioned, one of the most notable examples, I think, is Alfred's wife, Ealhswith, and she's not mentioned once in the biography about him by name. So there's all that, as you say, it's just his wife. So you have this entire big book about him, and she's not named. And that just tells us something about the attitudes at the time and the sources and why there's that bias, you know, because it's not that they weren't important and they weren't doing things. It's just that the sources aren't there. So that makes it really hard. And I kept going, you know, my editor kept going, put more women in, put more women in. And I'm like, well, yeah, all right, I'll try. And it's quite hard.
It is hard, but you know, they obviously did. You know, there was women who were mothers and grandmothers and wives and so were like connected to several of those kings. So it is a shame we don't get. Do we know much more about Emma of Normandy?
So I mean, she's one of the ones that we know the most about, probably actually, partially because she was in power for a really long time, and she's actually the queen, the wife of two kings, starting with Ethelred and then Cnut. So she's in charge for a long time. She has lots of sons who later become kings as well. But then she's also clearly a really powerful person in her own right. So she co-rules with Cnut. And we see this in illustrations where they're sat side by side and clearly both having a really important role, which is quite unusual. And she then goes on to really try and push her children or her sons towards being king. So she's doing a lot of maneuvering around. And as a part of that, she also has her own biography written about her. So she commissions this, which she's very modest, obviously. So she calls it In Praise of Emma. That's the name of her biography, just to make it clear that, you know. So this is a sort of PR story, really, that she's putting out there. So we don't quite know how much of it is true. There's obviously a little bit of exaggeration in that. It's a bit like, you know, what you put on Instagram as opposed to what you might put in reality, I think. But no, so we do know quite a lot about her because of all of this, and also because she's an ancestor of William the Conqueror. So she's his great aunt, which means that for him, she's really important. Yeah. So he likes to push that, you know, I'm connected to this formidable queen of England, so I have a right to come and just take over and take your country, basically. So that helps. So that helps keeping her memory sort of alive, I think.
But as you say, that's so connected with the creation of what we would consider modern England and the modern United Kingdom as well. The whole events of 1066 and what preceded them is what made the country what it is. And she's sort of right in the centre of that.
Absolutely. And it's that link to the yellow, because really, it's in this earlier period that all of that happened. England really is created a little bit more in the 9th, 10th century, really. That's when all these kingdoms turn into one big country. And the Normans really emphasise this and their link to that and that sort of those events from 1066. So they just see her, especially, as that connective part, I suppose.
Yeah. And I grew up in Somerset. I'll mention this and see if there's anything that comes up from this. But I grew up in Somerset. I wasn't born in Somerset, but I grew up in Cheddar, where our school, the Kings of Wessex, was built on the grounds of a Saxon palace that was sort of discovered as they were building. And there's obviously quite a big history of Alfred around there. The Alfred jewel was found nearby as well, which is a very famous piece of jewellery from that time. Have you been to the Kings of Wessex in Cheddar? Have you had a look around there?
Yeah, I've been to Cheddar. I haven't actually seen where that building was, but I know all about it. I have learnt about it, so I do. I've seen the plans, I've seen the reports. But that is one of those really fascinating places, because those early 9th century structures, we don't really get much of them because they're usually timber buildings. They're not great big stone cathedrals, so there's very few. So actually to have found one like that is quite quite exciting, and it's quite great to sort of see that link to Alfred as well.
Yeah, good. I'm glad that it's obviously Wessex and was a kingdom, so it's and that incorporated Winchester as well, didn't it? So it is sort of surprising to think of the West Country as being part of an important place, but Cheddar was important, which is good.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Let's talk about, the Viking you mentioned, which is the Viking king in there, which is Canute. People might be surprised to know there was a Viking king of England that late on in our history as well.
Yeah, and I get surprised that people don't know. He was actually king of England for 18 years, and he was an extremely successful king. He was very popular. It was a very sort of peaceful time. And then people seem to only know him for this story of him trying to hold back the waves, which, again, is also kind of misunderstood. It's almost become a bit of a joke that if somebody is trying to do something impossible, then that he was silly or stupid for trying to hold back the waves. But what we was actually trying to do was to show that even a king couldn't control nature, couldn't control God. So he was actually a very sort of good and wise king. So we get told really that the Vikings were all driven out by Alfred. In fact, I go on about this quite a lot. I had to take the life in the UK test for British citizenship quite recently, and there is literally a question on that test that says, who defeated the Vikings? And of course, the answer to that is Alfred, which is kind of wrong when you later on have a Viking king. So
when you took that test, did you say, well, actually, that did not happen? So, and then not pass, or did you put that down and say, I'll just say what they want to hear?
Yeah, it was a multiple choice, and it took all my strength not to put my hand up and go, excuse me. It was quite challenging, but it's like, do I want a passport or not? Yes, I do. So I had to just tick it.
Well, it is, but it's interesting. I find it fascinating that the stories we remember most of, the stories we remember about Alfred and the stories we remember about Canute, probably never happened. It's sort of the thing that, and Harold as well, those things, the arrow in the eye, the burning the cakes and the turning back the tide, either didn't happen or, almost certainly would not what we think. So it's interesting the way that history, our imaginations latch onto something, and that gives us an anchor in that time, but then often, and even the tests are wrong about it.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of that has got to do with things that go into what we learn at school, because you probably learned these things at school as a child. Yeah. And so they tend to be things that are in textbooks and things that are just being told again and again and perpetuated. So that's part of the problem. And some of those is quite funny in trying to unravel where they come from. And you see that some of them go back to Victorian times and times of empire. So Alfred becomes hugely popular when the empire is expanding, because here's this local hero who's sort of beating people coming into the country and setting up this great new nation, which is exactly what they want. And so a lot of those stories start there. And then they're just retold, and nobody goes back and goes, but hang on a minute, is that really true? Or if you do, you're sort of accused of, I don't know, all sorts of horrible things.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully eventually an archaeologist will discover the burnt cakes and then we can prove it happened, and then he's written Alfred on top of them, and then we'll be fine. So that we never know. We never know what happened. There's lots of, obviously you, because of your knowledge of bones, there's lots of interesting things about bones. I think I might have known this before, but I found this a fascinating fact about why, when you go to major battlefields where you'd expect there to be a lot of bodies, and or at least the bodies would have been buried somewhere, that you often are not finding any or very minimal number of bones at all. Could you explain why that is?
Yeah, that's always a bit of a puzzle, really, because we have all these enormous battles, lots of them, and especially from the Viking Age, we've got records of them. And a lot of time we know, you know, that thousands of people, thousands of men were killed, and they're going to be left there. They're not going to be picking them up and taking them away. So what happens, and why haven't we found them? There should be bones all over the place, really, in these places. But one example of that is actually the Battle of Waterloo, where, again, you know, thousands and thousands of men were killed. But what we do know about that battle is that people actually went back for those remains, for those skeletons. They were thrown into quite shallow graves, but then they were essentially stolen. So what people do is they come and they pick up anything valuable. So they pick up all the metal, any weapons, any uniforms, anything that's of value. And then they also come back for the bones. And we have all these records that actually the bones were taken and ground up and used for fertilizer, which is a pretty horrific thought. but there's a huge industry. Teeth were used for dentures. For Waterloo teeth was quite a popular thing for a very long time. So if you needed fake teeth, you could get them from a battlefield somewhere. And that's probably one of the things that's happened over the years, because, you know, bone meal, like you'd have bone meal in your garden if you're a gardener. Normally not human bone meal, but animal. But human bones as well, if you're just finding them lying around, that seems to be what's happened. So it's a pretty gruesome thought, really, but I think that is that's sadly the reason.
Yeah, well, it's recycling, isn't it? So it's better than just being left to, you know, be discovered by an archaeologist to find out where you were born from your teeth. So
yeah, it might be a preferred option to some. Absolutely.
Yeah, look, I mean, because you're doing quite a lot with this book, because obviously it's about Winchester, it's about the bone chests themselves. And it's also giving a pretty comprehensive history of all the people that may be in there. And obviously, this is ongoing, this investigation into the bone chest. So it must have been quite a feat to even be allowed to get in there. And they have to do all the work in the cathedral. Is that right? Because they're not allowed to take the bones out of the cathedral. So it's one of those things where it's very difficult. I know with the princes in the tower who are meant to be in Westminster Abbey, I think, the queen wouldn't give permission for them to be tested to find out if they really are who they are supposed to be. Was it difficult for people to get the permission, and B, is there anything you can tell us that has been discovered, that or are you keeping it close to your chest?
Yeah, so I'm not actually involved in the project directly myself, and so I haven't got anything else I can share, I'm afraid. It's not come out there yet. Very carefully guarded what the progress is. And I think the cathedral was very positive to it and to understanding it and to doing it now. It has taken a long time. The project started in 2012, so there were a lot of issues with that. Also, technology, so initially in 2012, actually what we can do now is so much more advanced than in 2012. So there were a lot of issues around things like contamination. So a few of the sort of photos and things that you can see in films, you can see if you go and visit the cathedral, you can see a little film of when they were sampling them, you know, completely covered everything and so careful with avoiding contamination. So there's lots of issues like that. And as you say, the fact that they have to stay there, they had to put up a sort of temporary lab so that they can do the work. And it's really confusing because when they counted the crushed up remains in these chests, there were over 1,300 individual pieces. So that's a pretty extensive jigsaw puzzle when you don't actually know what it's going to look like and how it's going to be. So it's an extremely challenging project to work on. But you know, it's getting, it's essentially getting easier all the time because we can now do more and more with those remains. So,
yeah,
fingers crossed.
At what point do you think, how long is it going to go on? Or is there just no end in sight? Will it just go on till it goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's things in progress and there's definitely more analysis. It also helps to have more material to compare it to. So now there's some really big, great big projects looking at more Anglo-Saxon skeletal remains from elsewhere in the country, which we didn't have 10 years ago. All of a sudden we have lots more. So the more databases you have to compare it against, the better. And the good thing about the data from these analyses is that it's basically just figures in a spreadsheet. And so once you've got it and you've got other things to compare it to, you can keep on working on it. So you get the data out of the bones and then you can do stuff with it later on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just even the history of the bone chests is fact, you know, that all the revolutionary stuff and the Civil War stuff of them being smashed to pieces and put back together again. So we're lucky to have them, anything at all, though obviously there were 9 chests, but there were more than 6 chests to begin with. So there's some chests that are lost, but most of the contents, I'm guessing, is still. So would anything have been like lost in that in that time, you know, when they were attacked, or did they manage to find all the bits and get them back in different boxes?
So I think, yeah, originally we definitely know there were 10 chests, possibly some more earlier ones when we go back to the medieval times, but certainly in the 16th or 17th century, when we know that this parliamentarian attack took place, there were 10. And so the parliamentarian soldiers who smashed up pretty much most of the inside of Winchester Cathedral managed to smash quite a few of them, 6 of them. 2 are replacements that were since made. So we know that all these bones were essentially just used. They're smashed to the ground. Some of the bones were used as missiles. They threw them at the stained glass windows. And the poor sort of clergy just had to go and scramble about and find what they could. And interestingly, when they did put the pieces back together again in this new project, you found all sorts of other stuff. So there was a little toy giraffe. There were a little animal bones mixed in there as well. So clearly at some point people are just going, yeah, that looks like a bone, let's stick it in a chest. And so so we would have lost quite a lot.
If my dog had been around, it definitely would have run off with, you know, William Rufus's leg bone or something. That's something to think about, isn't it? That probably there's a little dog with it running away with the king's bones. There's something in that.
Well, maybe that's where Alfred went. Who knows? happy pooch somewhere.
Well, there's loads of interesting stuff. We won't talk too much about the contents of the book because I would like people to buy it. It does achieve a lot, and there's a lot going on there. So it is if you're interested in that period or want to get into that period, it's a really good place to learn about this stuff. You did talk about Richard III a little bit. Was there amongst the archaeological community with this sort of, you know, it's a fascinating story, the discovery of the Richard III bones, and obviously has this weird provenance of the Richard III Society and sort of amateur archaeologists and historians being bang on, and apart from him not being having back issues. How did that go down amongst professional archaeologists? Was that, were you delighted he'd been found, or was it a weird thing to have this amateur person come in and discover everything?
Well, it's a really complicated one, actually, because we've got sort of mixed feelings about it, I think. I think there's what we don't really hear in the stories is that there was a huge team of archaeologists involved in that as well. So they're sort of putting just one amateur in charge and sort of making a discovery that we hadn't. It's not quite true. So there was quite a lot going on behind there, but obviously that's a much more attractive story. So I think if you actually look into the reality of it, there was a huge amount of real archaeology involved, and the fact that all the scientists got involved and how that will work, that was all absolutely brilliant. There's issues around it and the identification. You can start to question it a little bit because I know one, in the terms of the DNA, one of the sides, I think it's the paternal side, is actually wrong. So it doesn't actually, it's only the female. So it's put down as a false paternity event at some point in the history. That's how they put it, I think. So you know, there's all of that thinking, well, okay, so you've actually only got 50%. Some of the signs, you go, well, you know, so there's a lot of sort of memories and going, do we really know? So that's that, but that's kind of fun. We like that, academics. We quite like going, well, actually.
And he was found under a giant R, so it has to, that's the thing you have to take into account as well. There was an R above where he's found. So, you know, that for me is the clinch. But that again, that's why it's sort of weird that, you know, the male line has always been important in these things, when it's only the female line that you can be pretty certain that the mother is the mother, even though you can't be entirely sure the mother's the mother.
Yes.
So it's, I've always found that weird that you know, all these family trees go through the father as if that's the most important thing. We go, no, the mother, let's put this through the mother, and then we'll definitely know, because, you know, over all those generations there are bound to be a couple of false paternity events.
Yes,
I'm not calling all historical characters whores, but you know, that's possible.
No, but you know, it's going to be a little bit of that, isn't it, in history? So I think we need to be realistic, don't we, over that many generations? But yeah, that was a good point.
And so when it comes to writing a book like this, you know, it's obvious, you know, there's so much stuff to put together here, and it's a very well constructed book, and you've obviously worked very hard on it. How long do you put aside to write a book like this, and does it take that long, or what's your process, I suppose, in putting something like this together?
So this one took me about 2 years to write, really. Not full time, because I've got lots of other work and other things that I do, but alongside that, it was a challenging one, because I was trying to make it a little bit more interesting, not just a sort of dull start at the beginning, go through all the names and all the battles and all the dates, but, you know, trying to get those characters. So there's a lot of jumping in and out and trying to find the new stories and find the new research. And I've got I'm not very good at starting at the beginning and then getting to the end. So I just do it and completely haphazard, anything that grabs me and seems exciting. And then I sort of put it together. I literally print things out and put them on my floor and get my scissors out and try and move stuff around till it works. But I think, you know, I always just think, if I don't find it interesting and exciting when I'm writing it, how on earth is somebody reading it going to find it interesting? It's got to be exciting enough for me to tell the story. So that's part of it. But it's, you know, there's a lot of research and there's a lot of fun bits where you go down a library and you dig out an ancient book and you find a little reference to something that leads you and sort of solves a little problem. So it does feel like detective work, you know, you're having to unravel things and learn a lot as well. So even though, you know, this is part of my period, this book is much more historical than stuff I've worked on before. So it's a steep learning curve as well. So you're sort of sitting there going, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to try and write it anyway.
Yeah, and if there are a few, so there's a few sources, but there's also a few documents outside. And I think you mentioned a letter from Canute or something like that that's presumably still exists. So there's a chance that other thing, and again with Roman stuff, a lot of things turns up, doesn't it? Either in Herculaneum libraries or just been written over in a library somewhere or just hidden away in a library somewhere. So there's a chance that there may be. It seems extraordinary that a letter from Canute would survive, I have to say, but there's a chance that stuff like that could survive.
Absolutely, and things have been mistranslated you know, sometimes you don't realise them. But then you also have issues with forgeries, because there's a lot of forgeries of these early documents, so trying to work out what's real and what's not, you know. But things can definitely turn up, so there's always that little bit of excitement that new things are discovered and it might change everything. I hope not. Well, except that means I could get a second version. And, you know, maybe.
Well, it does feel, I mean, if it's going to be years down the line, then it makes sense to write the book now, but it does feel like, you know, there's more. There should be a second book once all the information is out, or if there is more discovered than any amazing discoveries. But it does feel like Winchester are missing a trick here. You know, it's sort of crazy to me that this isn't just world famous. This, you know, they probably just need to find Alfred, and then that everyone will be happy. But even so, there's some good people in here. There's some good ones, and they're properly old. So it's kind of crazy that there isn't a bit more going on.
I completely agree.
And did you do the audiobook yourself? I've listened to the audiobook, but it was a while ago. I can't. Are you reading your own audiobook?
Yes.
How did you find that?
Bit of a nightmare because all these names again. That was the hardest part because, yes, one thing is remembering them and writing them. Then there's spelling them, and then there's pronouncing them.
Yeah.
And, you know, how on earth do you do that? Because actually, we don't really even agree. So even among, you know, linguists and historians, people spell them differently, people pronounce them differently. I'm not a linguist. I don't. That's not my expertise at all. I'm not even, you know, English isn't even my first language. So it's a kind of, how do we try and do that when you're sitting there in a studio and something came up? And we had the fun, the most amusing one was the one who's spelt S-E-A-X-B-U-R-H.
Right.
So I had a long discussion with my producer who was adamant it was going to be pronounced Sexburg, and I said, no, I don't think she's really called Sexburg. And we had this huge debate. I had to check with colleagues, and no, it wasn't Sexburg, it's Seesburg or Seba, okay, or something like that, but definitely not Sexburg. So you get those, and you're trying to sit there with a straight face and go, am I gonna pronounce it that way? So
get to the point when you're writing something that you start not putting in words that you're not sure how to pronounce, which is a bit more difficult in this case. we had to ring up. It was quite a lot of medical terms in there. Someone had to go and check them. And I think that's interesting. You talk about writing, which, you know, I think it is a good way to write generally, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, of just writing the bit you want to write and then dealing with it later. Because I think the hardest thing about writing is often just getting on with it. You get sort of stuck somewhere, and I can imagine you could get stuck in this book quite easily with one of the more obscure and the slightly duller early Kings. And so, you know, you go on to write something that you're interested in or that's really grabbing you, and then I think that's the sort of, because this is such a, but this is all, you know, it's a huge jigsaw, this whole book, really, isn't it? This human jigsaw made of actual bits of people, and so it sort of makes sense to write it that way as well. So that's very interesting. I really enjoyed it. I think there's loads in there, and it's really interesting stuff. And I think, you know, again, Winchester, pull your finger out and make something of this. They need some character to, don't they? They need a character that can do a film about the character of finding King Alfred's toe bone or something. We'll see. Anyway, are you reading anything else at the moment, or have you read anything recently that you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, well, the latest one I read is one that's about to come out, actually. I've got a podcast as well called The Rabbit Hole Detectives, and one of my co-hosts, Charles Spencer, has just written a book that's about to come out, which is a lot more serious one. It's a sort of memoir book that he's written called A Very Private School, which is about the boarding school system, really, and what it's like to grow up in that. But one of the things that really struck me on that is the history of it, and he goes into how that essentially has shaped all these people who are now really running the country, and why that came about was just stuff I didn't know about. I went to boarding school for a year when I was 15 and had a great time, but I realized the people who were sent out at the age of 8 absolutely did not, for the most part. And so he's written this fantastic book about why that's come about, and what, you know, as a personal memoir and a history, and putting that whole into context of English society, which I would highly recommend.
Good. I do like his history books. I think, again, they're you know, he chooses interesting subjects, and they're very kind of written, you know, in a very readable style. I like the one about the White Ship one. I really enjoyed. And he did one about the King Charles escaping, the King Charles II, it must have been. So this is how bad my memory is, both history and things I've read about him managing to escape when he was likely to get killed. He's extremely good. I'll try and get him on the podcast. Now I've got a link to him. That's good news for me. Great. Well, I'll read that when it comes out. That sounds terrific. Look, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. And dear, go and listen to the Rabbit Hole Detectives as well, which is a fabulous podcast as well. Kat Jarman, The Bone Chests. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, like that one, for all his hard work, and Ben Evans as well. And thank you, Kat, for joining us.
That was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. RichardHerring.com/ballback/tour or RichardHerring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStripe.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.